Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
One to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at AlwaysReadyCollective.com.
Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for listening, liking, subscribing, sharing, helping us get on Amazon's new podcast service, which is really cool. That definitely upped the listenership already, and we've only been on there for like 48 hours. So really appreciate all the support.
Yeah, everybody, welcome. It's your first time. We're glad to have you. It's been a little while since we've recorded, actually. We've had had some in the bank that we were getting out, so if I'm off my stride, I apologize, but glad you're here. You're going to enjoy what you listen to today. We have quite a salty sailor with us today. So, sorry, Coastie. We aren't sailors, we're Coasties. And we're going to have a good time. After you listen to this one, go back, listen to some more, do all the things Phil said. Subscribe, like, send us some comments, tell us what you want. If you've got a good story, reach out. We'd love to hear it.
Yeah, hey, with that, who we have on the line or who we have with us here live on Crowdcast is Bosun Kurt Strauch, retired. He was born in, might have to help me say this, Washington, Minnesota, and raised all over the United States. Washtenka. Yep. I was close. I tried. It's hard when you write it down, try to pronounce it. Joined the Coast Guard back in 1984 in his junior year of high school. He was in the reserves, graduated high school in 85 and went active. Recruit company KBEC 118. From there, he was at the Coast Guard cutter White Sage out of Woods Hole, Mass. Went to AETA school, decided that he wanted to join a real rate, and dropped on requests, came back, and ended up going bosun mate for the remainder of his career. But from A school, Coast Guard Station Montauk, New York, and then the Coast Guard cutter Chandelure out of Miami Beach, Station Provincetown, Mass, Group Air Station Cape May, Coast Guard cutter Polar Star. He's on the Coast Guard cutter Basswood out of Guam, and then the Sassafras. IMARV, which we're definitely going to have to ask him about because it sounded interesting, out of Taylor's Island, Maryland on the Eastern Shore. Then Coast Guard Station Oxford, Coast Guard cutter Beluga out of Little Creek, Sector Field Office, Southwest Harbor as the Aton officer. Then the Coast Guard cutter Gallatin out of Charleston, where he rounded out his career and after 25 years, retired as a bosun too. Mr. Strauch, welcome aboard, sir.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Kurt, welcome. We're glad we got you on. And with that lengthy introduction from Phil, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Yeah, I think it's stories. I've been thinking about this for the last week, and most of the stuff revolves around fires. it seems to be a constant theme with my career, which is carried to my retirement as well. Yeah, multiple units, multiple fires, some pretty interesting ones. Had one off of, while I was up in Montauk, New York, it was a 80-foot Eastern rig scalloper about 10 miles offshore, middle of the night. We got called out about 1:30 a.m. Got out there, 4 to 6 foot seas, took the 41 out. This is back before you had to do all your risk assessment before getting underway and planning and all that. So
the good old days, we call it.
Yeah. So from when the alarm went off to when we got underway, it was like a minute and a half, which is pretty good for 1:30 in the morning, but got underway with a 41, got out on scene. I had a break-in coxswain with me and was letting him pretty much do everything. As we're pulling up to this scalloper, there's beautiful, nice flames just shooting off the stern. I mean, there was one, it was blue, about 30 feet long, just blasting off the stern of this scallop boat. And just, I'm looking at it going, wow, that's awful pretty. So we talk about our approach, and I was letting the break-in coxswain do everything. And he's like, the book says you got to approach upwind. And I'm like, well, you're in a 41. It's got a flat stern. The seas are going to push you. He goes, yeah, but the book says. I was like, all right, go ahead. Approach from upwind. The entire crew of the scalloper was up on the bow, huddled up there. You know, of course, this is the middle of winter, too. I forgot that part.
Of course.
Yeah. Always. So they're all huddled up on the bow. So he makes his approach. And just as he's about to come up to the scalloper, we had a wave hit us in the stern, picked up the stern, surfed the boat up, and slammed the bow on the gunwale of the scalloper. Put a huge dent in the bow. And I just looked at him. I said, and that is why you don't approach from upwind and up sea in these kind of conditions.
Lesson learned.
What have we learned today, Junior?
Yeah. So we get everybody off the boat, start fighting a fire. We had just done some PMS on a fire monitor earlier or the day before. So we had the fire monitor all rigged, started fighting a fire. We fought it a while, got it out, got it completely out. And just as it's starting to just all the flames have died down and it's only smoking now, I got a call from Group Mariches. And they're like, hey, your OD wanted us to pass on a message. Did you guys think about oxygen and acetylene tanks on that boat?
Mm.
And I went, oh, yes, we did. Hadn't given it a single thought. But I was like, but as I'm sitting there going, yes, we did, I'm like, that explains that blue flame.
Right? Uh-huh, that was it. Yep.
So then I end up down in Miami on the Chandelure. And we end up getting called out.
Kirk,
yeah.
Before you go to the next part, just to, you know, so what you're talking about is something that's kind of foreign to any new crewman or coxswain on a Coast Guard boat, because there are no fire monitors fitted to the boats anymore. Could you talk a little bit about, like, the 41's capabilities to fight fire back when men were men?
Yeah, so the 41 had a portable fire monitor. It's a big water cannon that you could rig up. Had a fire pump on the forward end of one of the engines that you could engage and then put some good water on, you know, any burning pier, fire, you know, a boat, whatever. And we carried foam with us too. So, you know, you could do some firefighting. The biggest thing was protection, you know, protect people and get them out of the situation, then back off. But if there was a fire and it wasn't too big, you could actually fight it. And it limited your maneuverability on the 41 when you engaged the fire pump. Because you were only allowed to, you were maxed out on your, you had a maximum limit to your RPMs with the fire pump engaged. Otherwise you'd blow it up. But it was good. You could, you know, it gave you an added capability, and it wasn't just standing up there with a fire hose. The monitor actually set down into the forward bit. It actually, you pull the plug, same spot where the tow line came out of on that one. set the fire monitor down, plugged everything in, and just have one guy up there just spraying water. So it was pretty neat.
How things have changed, Tom Bill.
I mean, yeah. I got a 4-pound dry chem fire extinguisher now.
Yeah, right. And
fire monitor was really nice.
Yeah.
Didn't get used very much, but you know, the other nice thing about it is, you know, if your peer was, you know, like I was in Provincetown and we had a concrete pier that was a quarter mile long, and the seagulls would love to drop crabs and clams and everything else on it. And other things, but so you could rig the fire monitor up, and at high tide, you just run the boat down alongside the pier, and a guy would spray the pier off.
Yeah, a little training, little maintenance all at once.
Right.
I like it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So,
go ahead, Bill.
So, well, I was going to ask Kurt, because I think I know what it means, but I'm guessing a lot of our listeners don't. When you refer to that scallop boat as Eastern rigged, what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, the pilot house is aft, the work deck's forward. So, yeah, so you got a nice big work deck. And normally on those boats, they store at least back then, they would store oxygen and acetylene tanks on the backside of the pilot house because it was more protected from the elements back there. You're not taking away the forward or anything like that. So, and the funny thing with this one is that I had towed it like 2 weeks before into Montauk Harbor with the 44, hung it up on a bar going into the harbor, powered over it, and swung shot it into a commercial fishing pier, almost lost control. That was a bad story. But they wanted us to tow this scalloper back to port after we put the fire out. And I'm like, I had already towed it with a 44, knew its weight, knew where it was, just dumped a couple thousand gallons of water.
It's a little heavier now, too. Yeah.
Yeah. They've been fishing for a couple of weeks since I had towed them in. And I was like, no. Point Judith had a 44 out there. I was like, no, at this point, it exceeds your limits. So we just let it go.
Yeah.
Get back to the station. The BM1 looks at me and goes, well, if you'd brought it back, I'd put you in for a medal. It's like, okay,
I brought the people back.
Yeah, I brought the seven guys back.
Yeah, that's a man.
Sorry, left the boat out there. So anyway, so then I end up down in Miami on the Chandelure, and we ended up getting called out while I was down there. We got recalled. We were supposed to get underway that day anyway, but they got us underway about an hour early. It's a 180-foot Honduran freighter that was on fire in the Straits of Florida off of, Biscayne Bay National Wildlife Sanctuary.
Yep.
The crew had evacuated, so we get out there and we start pumping water onto it. This freighter is loaded with cars, trucks, motorcycles, has
a whole bunch of stuff with gasoline in it.
Yeah, a whole bunch of stuff with gasoline, diesel, has a trailerable generator on the back end of it, generator or compressor, one of the two, on the back end up by the pilot house, and then three huge, I believe they were like 80-gallon propane tanks secured to the pilot house. So we start spraying water on this thing. And it's big. They ended up, we ended up with two 110s out there and a 41 and a 210, the 210 out of Miami, the Dauntless. So we're the two 110s, I forget what the other one was. We're going back and forth, taking turns, spraying water. And of course, because of all the gas and everything else, we're expending foam, you know, like crazy. We went through all the foam that we had on our boat. The other 110 went through all of theirs. The 41 in the meantime is doing helo ops with Air Station Miami. They're trucking foam canisters to Miami, heloing them out. Helo's dropping them onto the 41, and we're alternating. They would dump a load onto us, and as the other 110 would, as we'd finish up, you know, unloading the foam from the 41, the other 110 would be running out of foam, so then we'd take over. So we fought it, and it was drifting towards Biscayne National Wildlife Sanctuary. So they're like, hey, you got to tow it out of there because we don't want it on the ground. So we got tasked with towing it. There's no one on this freighter. The fires are up forward for the most part. They were all over. But so we rigged up, came up to it, lassoed the forward bit and started towing it. Got the tow secure. You know, underway to pull it further out in the straits and headed down for some chow because it was about lunchtime by now. And just as you start shoveling the food in, you could hear a pow, you know, tow line snaps. Mm. Run back up on deck, recover the tow line. They're like, we didn't get it out far enough. We got to tow it further. So rig another bridle / lasso and to go up and lasso the bit again to get it to start towing it again. The hull on the forecastle was cherry red as we're pulling up to it. It was near white at this point in time. The fires were so hot. We used the wire rope bridle or wire rope lasso to lasso the forward bit on his boat, on his freighter, so we could tow it out of there. I got tagged with lassoing the bit. So I'm holding the wire rope to lasso the bit. I'm all the way forward on the forecastle on a 110. I got BM1. I was a BM2 at the time. I got the BM1 and two of my non-rates tending the tow line behind me. And they're sitting there cheering me on. You know, you're all pumped up doing stuff right. Like this. But you can do it. You can do it. And I'm like, oh, great. Yeah, I got some support. And just as I'm about ready to lasso it a bit, you hear this enormous roar. And it's really hard to describe what happens when the rupture discs on 3 80-gallon propane tanks let go because of a fire. And I just look up, and all I see is this entire – it is an enormous black cloud of smoke over the stern of this freighter. The entire back end was basically engulfed at this point. And I hear a very faint over the roar. I hear a very faint, you can do it. I turn around and I look, and every single one of those bastards had run behind the superstructure, leaving me up forward alone.
It's good.
So anyway, we got a lassoed. Yeah, we got a lassoed. We got it towed out. The Dauntless started shooting 3-inch rounds at it to try and sink it because we just couldn't get the fire out, which was another funny episode. We had just got the 25mm on the 110. We had just done the change out on that, and we were looking forward to shooting that. But the Dauntless insisted on using their 3-inch.
Did they hit it at all?
They hit the mast of the freighter. They hit probably about 2 miles downrange. They hit halfway in between the freighter and them. They hit it a couple times. Yeah. But it was really pitiful shooting on a gun crew's part. Eventually, we were able to pump enough water into it and sink it in the straits. So, but yeah, that was that one.
That's awesome. That's
crazy.
What a great story. What do you think? Why do you think the Coast Guard transitioned away from fighting fires? Because, I mean, you were in as late as 2009, so not too long ago, and it seemed like firefighting was kind of headed out the door probably even before then.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it headed out the door for fighting fires on piers, shore structures, and other boats. You know, the focus started to become save the people, don't worry about it. I believe, from what I saw, you know, there were very few fires that we actually did fight on small boat stations. So it's not like we did a whole lot of training fighting fires on other boats. So there was the risk side to it. And I know there's a money side to it, you know, maintaining all that equipment when you don't use it. Sure. You know, there's a cost tied to it. So got us away from it. On the flip side, you know, if you have to, you don't have the training to do it. It's kind of like towing. And I saw a decrease in the knowledge of towing over the course of my career. You know, you'd get towards the end, you know, when I had the Beluga and I was doing some training for the, what is it? The RBS, the 41 replacement program. So we'd hook up.
The RBM.
The RBM program. They had the prototypes and they'd come in to tow us, and there was no knowledge on how to tow a larger vessel at that point, you know, which was really sad when I looked at it, because it's like, you know, that's the whole basis. But that was commercial, you know, commercial tow companies coming in and taking over for that. You know, so you didn't get the, so the guys don't get the training as much as they, you know.
Right, not but that real world experience.
Yeah, yeah. Nothing. You go we out, tell you, each other quite you a leave bit. The boat there is basically what it comes down to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Any more fires?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I did.
Pulled into where did we pull into? Oh, yeah. We pulled into Charleston, South Carolina, right after, a couple weeks after Hurricane Hugo. And they have had a construction tender up there. And we pulled into the pier, just got into Charleston from coming up from Miami. We're expecting to clean up, get some liberty. And just as we're securing a line, the GQ alarm goes off, or the general emergency alarm goes off on our ship, and they pipe the fire team away. And I'm like, we're not supposed to be doing any training. They had an engine room fire on a construction tender, so ended up down in the engine room on that one. Fortunately, there I installed the suppression system, put it out, so it was just making sure it was fully out on that one. Polar Star, I went through a couple on that one. Had a fire in the incinerator.
Why isn't Polar Star always catching fire? What is it about the Arctic cutters that they just catch fire?
Well, let's see. For the incinerator fire, that was a funny one. The firemen that were burning oily rags and oil filters didn't follow the exact procedures on how much to put in the incinerator at a time. There was a limit.
Hey, so, Liberty's coming. Got to get it done.
No, we were actually underway.
Oh, really?
Which makes it even worse. But right. It was a new – the incinerator had just gotten installed in the yards that we had we got done with prior to sailing south. So they came up. They're like, hey, we got to burn these rags and these oily rags and these filters. And I'm like, okay, make sure no more than 1 kilo every 30 minutes to an hour, which is 2.2 pounds.
Right.
And they're like, okay. Well, I left the incinerator room. I was a chief master at arms at the time. And I come back up about 45 minutes later. And as I come up the ladder into the incinerator room, it goes from a nice clear view to haze at the 3 foot level. And as I step, so I'm like, this isn't good. And I look up at the stack from the incinerator where it went up through the overhead. And where there was no insulation on the stack, I swear I could see through it.
Right.
It was that hot. And there was a flame that kept shooting out of the bottom of the incinerator through one of the vents and hitting a bulkhead across the room from it. And I'm like, this isn't good. So I called up to the bridge. I said, hey, can you have the A-Gang MKC? Can you request his presence in the incinerator room? So they piped his presence and I went, you know what? I think I better call away to fire. So I called back up. I said, actually set general emergency. There's a fire in the incinerator room. So it kind of became a joke on a Polar Star while I was there. If I had somebody like the A-Gang chief pipe to, if I called up the bridge and requested A-Gang chief's presence somewhere, that they should stand by for another phone call requesting the general.
That it was coming.
Yeah, they knew something was coming. So we had a oil spray fire on the aft end of the centerline free turbine.
That's scary.
Outside the turbine enclosure. So, and I was part of the rapid response team on that one. So we'd go running down into the turbine room. And of course there was no communication on the rapid response team's part. So half of us went running in on the starboard side. The other half went running in on the port side. The guys who ran in on the port side had a PKP extinguisher and we had a hose. So
you could wash the PKP off, right?
Well, we weren't talking. So the DC-3 would spray the PKP and right as he'd start pressing spraying the PKP, the guy, our nozzleman on our side would open a bail on the fire hose. So it would spray it right back.
Yep, sounds about right.
We ended up putting it out. Walk up on deck, and the DC-3 is completely white, covered. going, I got to have a smoke and watch right. that. You're kidding me, right? So, yeah. So there was that one. Probably the worst one, though, that I did fight was the Gallatin when we were in dry dock down in Charleston, South Carolina. Most of the crew was off. Shipyard worker cut into the hull a little higher than where he thought he was cutting. And the storekeepers had stored all kinds of documents in engineering supply room up against the hull. And that's where he cut into it. And most of the guys were off. The DCC, and I was following the DCC aft from the chief's mess into the mess deck. And as the two of us look up, you could just, the entire mess deck was filled with smoke. So, and that's when the first alarm came out for that one. So he's like, I'm going back, you know, because he was rapid response. I was rapid response. He grabbed the OBA. I was like, not an OBA, sorry. We had already made the transition over to air packs. So he grabbed an air pack saying he was going back. I was like, yeah, not by yourself. So I grabbed an air pack. The two of us headed back there. It got pretty hot. Tried to make entry into engineering space, into engineering stores. He was the nozzleman initially. Had two guys backing him up on the hose. I ended up coming in behind the number two hoseman. About the time that he DCC was like, yeah, my air is getting low. And so he bailed off the nozzle. The hoseman, number one hoseman, bailed with him because they both had tanks at the same time. Of course, I'd gotten my tank the same time the DCC got his. The number two hoseman moved up to nozzleman. He spent, in my estimation, it was probably about 10 seconds on the nozzle. It might have been 30, but it wasn't much longer. So I ended up with the nozzle with no one behind me. The scene leader was standing there trying to get more people on the hose. Didn't have enough really hose to get down into space. Had it to get in a little ways. So I'm standing on the ladder in the hatch going into e-stores, trying to put water over into the area of the fire. And I'm just like, I was cooking because it's the only access into e-stores and you got a raging fire going on down there. In my ODUs going, man, it's warm, as I'm spraying a fire. And then I'm like, oh, maybe I should roll my sleeves down. Rolled my sleeves down. I'm like, okay, this is better. Scene leader's like, hey, you know, asking me about my air. I'm like, I don't know. I can't see the gauge. I'm focused on this. Turns out I was running a little low on air. Finally got somebody to take the nozzle from me. And my low tank alarm, low air alarm went off probably 30 feet from the entrance into that space as I was walking out of the ship. Ended up going back in a second time, got a new tank. Charleston Fire Department was on scene. They needed somebody to show them down in the space. So I'm like, yep, I'll go. So took a team of professional firefighters into the ship, down into the space. I actually got all the way down into engineering stores that time. Stepped in an open manhole for a tank up to my knee. Decided to approach the fire from a different spot. Had a nifty walk around. I get right up to the cage where the fire is roaring. It's warm. I'm winded. Pissed because my knees hurt because I stepped in that open manhole. Got four firefighters, professional firefighters with me. And I'm like, guys, I can see the flames. Get me a hose. We can start putting water on this. And the fire is just rolling across the overhead at this point. It was going pretty good. And I can hear them talking. All right, is this the only way to access it? All this. I'm like, get me a hose. I can see the flames. And they're like, we don't have a hose. I'm like, you're the professional firefighters. You know, you would think they'd bring a hose with them.
Right down under the fire.
So we got five people down in this space, no hose, a roaring fire. And they're like, what are we going to do? And I'm just sitting there going, you got to be kidding me. And I hear one of them say, well, it's getting kind of hot down here. And the other one goes, yep, and we don't have a hose. Maybe we should back out. I'm like, all right, I'm out of here. Make sure y'all get out of here. We ended up fighting that for, I believe it was like 6 hours. Ended up cutting a hole in the side of the hall and just pumping foam into the space and flooding it out to put it out. That was pretty bad. I went through three tanks on that one. I ended up on the ship three times. I actually got kicked off at one point. So, but
why'd you get kicked off?
I got kicked off because I had already gone through two tanks. I was overheated, I needed to have been kicked off before that, but I got kicked off. And I'm sitting there going, I got my retirement letter in. What the hell am I doing?
What am I doing here?
Yeah. I was having fun, though. I was like, this is exciting. But, yeah, so, yeah, but, yeah. I mean, what is it? Four fires on the got called out for four possible fires on the Polar Star when I was on there. One on the Chandelure. No. Yeah, two on the Chandelure while I was on there. One at Montauk. Gallatin. Trying to think what else. Yeah. So, a lot of fires. Like I say, you know, it pretty much sums up my career. So when I retired, I actually had my retirement ceremony on September 11th under the hull of the ship in dry dock.
Very cool.
And that was my comment. This sums it up. I came in on a ship sitting on blocks in a dry dock. I'm leaving off a ship sitting on blocks in a dry dock.
So, full circle, huh?
Full circle. Oh, and the exclamation point was the September 11th. Right. Says everything.
Well,
so that was Kurt, a big part of it.
How did you decide to go bosun mate when you started out as an AET?
So I wanted, when I enlisted, when I signed my papers active duty, I put in for AT school. That's what I wanted. I had requested it. I wanted to be an aviation electronics tech. I was interested in, before I went active, I was thinking about going to college for electrical engineering, all of that. I was on the buoy tender. Was on there probably 8 months, and my BM2 said, you know what you're doing. Why don't you strike bosun mate? They had extended the wait for aviation schools. They had shut them down basically. So I said, all right, I'll strike. What the hell? So I struck bosun mate. Back then you had to take a service wide for third class if you struck. Almost guaranteed you make it, but there was a fail. You could fail the service wide. I passed. Didn't find out I passed the service wide until I was down at AT school. I think I was in week 13. The instructors came in with the Navy Times and, is this you? I'm like, yep, that's me. Next week I was a BM3. So made BM3 at AT school, took a 3-day weekend and went, I'm not challenged. It's kind of boring. I'm afraid that, you know, I'll probably be the guy working on a nav system on an aircraft somewhere. We go up for a test flight. Instead of flying to San Diego, we'll end up in Tampa. can't fly the helos. So I know I can drive boats. May as well stick with bosun mate.
Solid decision.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Solid ended decision.
Up, yep. Ended up on a Polar Star. We took PopDiv on board, you know, Polar Ops Division, the Hilo guys. And I was a chief at the time. And AT1 walks up to me, and he had been in my class at AT school.
Oh, and he goes, funny.
Goes, they framed your chit, and they're still pissed at you.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Who would drop out of an aviation school to go bosun mate? Yeah.
Only the smart ones.
Oh, they were not happy. I had to go talk to the XO, and he was not pleased with me.
Really? I bet, especially like week 13, probably.
Yeah, how long was that school then?
It was 21 weeks for the basic, you know, you get all, and then you started a couple C schools before you went to your unit. So it was basically 28 weeks.
So you were, you know, halfway, two-thirds of the way.
Yeah, I was over halfway.
That's horrible.
But
that light was horrible.
It was bad.
I'm sorry,
yeah.
Man. Yeah, that was pretty bad. I don't know.
It's really, it's starting to get dark. So I was trying to. you know, you want to see this.
It was like mood lighting, man.
You want to see the money.
It was mood lighting.
Yeah. Well, funny thing is, though, after I retired, I went to college, and I'm now an electrical engineer. So,
okay, full circle.
It just took me 25 years to mature enough to go to college.
There you go.
What are you working on now? Are you working on aircraft? Or are you working on?
I work on substations. So transmission substations. I don't like working anything less than 115 kilovolts. So I like working the bigger stuff. The stuff that you look at and you go, that could kill me.
There you go. Okay. I got
a buddy who does a similar job to you. And he said he likes that stuff because he's like, I'm more careful. He said, it actually scares me less because I know like it'll kill me if I screw up. So I don't take any, there's never any shortcuts. He goes, what scares me is working on my house because I get sloppy.
Yep. Yeah. You can hear the humming of the electricity. You're like, yep, that'll kill me.
Right. And throw me to the next county in the process.
Yep. It's funny because I used to give crap to all the engineers and now I are one.
Right.
Well, Kurt, what was your first coxswain letter on? What platform?
41 and 44.
What was the check ride like?
Yeah, it was a check ride. It was
back when check rides were check rides.
Yeah. I had a work for Montauk. We had a senior chief, Ed Michaels, and great guy, really hard guy to work for. Really big. He had his standards and you had to meet his standards in order to qualify. But he also had a lot of sayings that you'd shake your head going, what? You know, came in off of towing a boat in one day. He asked me how I put it to the pier. And I was still a break-in at the time. And the BM2 had said, just slingshot it into the pier. So I'm like, okay. So I slingshot it into the pier. So I get back to the station. He's like, how'd you tie it up? How'd you get it into the pier? I was like, oh, I just slingshot it into the pier. He's like, and he just got this look on his face and he goes, just because 747s land with their wheels up sometimes doesn't mean it's the right way to do it.
That's good.
Don't ever slingshot a boat to the pier. I'm like, gotcha. So, yeah.
Well,
that's funny. Hey, go ahead, Phil, if you got something.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 theme storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
Want to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at alwaysreadycollective.com.
Please tell us about IMARF Taylor's Island. That's because I think Phil and I are both like, IMARF. I've kind of got an idea
So with all those fires, this is probably my most dangerous assignment. So IMARF Taylor's Island is Independent Maritime Assistance Response Vessel. It was the Norwegian crude concept. The Coast Guard bought a boat specifically for this. By the time I got to Taylor's Island, they had put that up in New York. And Taylor's Island was running a converted 55-foot AIDS navigation boat.
Okay.
All right. Painted it white, so it was no longer black. Still had the crane on the aft deck.
Of course, because why would we take that off?
That's right. But we cradled a 13-foot rib on the back.
Okay.
And it was neat. We were based out of Taylor's Island. We had no shore facility. And so you could position the boat anywhere within your AOR. So we'd go down to Patuxent River because the Patuxent River Naval Air Station was in our AOR. Trying to remember. So anyway, we'd position all over the AOR. depending on where we thought the caseload was or whatever the needs were. We could also get called up from other stations to support them. So, you know, the graduation at Annapolis, they would have the Blue Angels do an air show. So we'd go up and we'd do safety up there for the Blue Angels air show or whatever, you know, they come up with various things and say, hey, we need you over here. So move the boat over there.
Well, what was the duty rotation like on that?
It was standard port starboard.
So it was just when you were at the station, you were just on the boat instead of
When you were at the station, you were on the boat. Want to get underway, you get on. If the guys wanted to get underway on a Tuesday afternoon, I would get off the boat. You know, I was the OIC at that one.
Okay.
You know, hey, yeah, we're going to go over this area. And I'm like, well, if you go over there, that's, 2 hours over, 2 hours back, you're going to have, and we're going to hang out over there overnight, you know? So like Monday, we're going to get the boat over and go over to this area and tie up there. All right. Well, let me know when you get back, keep me in call, and I had a laptop. I'd work from home.
That's cool. You know?
Sometimes I get underway with them. So September 11th hit and we got underway and our primary response was Pax River Naval Air Station to provide security for them. Pax River had more than enough security, nothing going on. So we redeployed up the Potomac to DC. And as we got up to the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, I believe it was the James Rankin was up there and they were providing security. And this is literally the Pentagon was still smoking all of that. So as we come up, we almost got shot because Coast Guard doesn't have any white 55-foot buoys.
Right. What is this?
And they're like, what is that? And they thought we were an imposter. And I'm calling up and they finally responded. And they had a BM-1 on that buoy tender who's like, oh, yeah, yeah. No, no, that's legit. That's not a – yeah, so – But yeah, so we spent 2 weeks under the old Woodrow Wilson Bridge while they were driving pilings for the new Woodrow Wilson Bridge, running 6 hours on, 6 hours off. And I only had enough beds ashore for the guys who were off, for half the guys. So I ended up spending 2 weeks on the 55 listening to them drive piles.
That's a long time. That's on enjoyable. 55 feet. Yeah.
Yeah. But we had completely shut down the Potomac River from the Woodrow Wilson Bridge up for an entire week. And then the second week we started letting some boats operate. And towards the end of that week, any boat that wanted to go north of the Woodrow Wilson had to be inspected, full space accountability, everything. And so we positioned on some pilings that they were using for construction to position barges for construction. We tied up to that. We had boats coming up along each side. We had them lined up down the Potomac, and we did in one day, I think we did 300 boardings, full space accountability.
Yeah, that's a massive lift.
Yeah.
And what do you guys, what were the capabilities that were fitted to the cutter once you painted it white? I mean, were you guys staffing, did you have mounted guns or anything?
Nope. Same case. I mean, we had standard long guns, nothing mounted.
I was going to say they had the Rankin parked up there and it didn't have anything bigger than an M16. I guarantee it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
True.
The scary part was the Navy E2s, E3s running around with a 50 cal on a boat.
That's
especially when they're
when you said Navy, right?
We need to get these guys off. Yeah. We asked that they get the guys off the water.
Yeah.
That's dangerous.
You know, that's when you learn that word deconfliction. Like, and it suddenly becomes really important when the Navy gets on scene. It's like, oh, yeah. Deconfliction's a thing. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah. But I ended up doing multiple trips up to DC for security ops following that, both on IMARF Taylor's Island and Beluga. I went up on Beluga like 4 or 5 times.
That's a long trip.
Security. Yeah. It is.
So you're in command of what was your first OIC tour?
Taylor's Island.
And then
I called up a buddy after I got orders to that. And his first question was, who'd you piss off? I got orders.
Sound like a worst duty.
Yeah, well, I got orders to Beluga, and another guy I knew goes, "Who'd you piss off?"
So, yeah. Did that count as sea time?
The IMARF? No. That was a shore unit. Yeah, that was stationed.
That's garbage.
Well, Kurt didn't need any more sea time. I think he's got.
Yeah, he was already salty. Yeah, he was salty.
So I had just over 10 years sea time, and two of it was in dry dock.
That's the best way to get sea time, I think.
A lot of emergency dry docks, you know.
Right.
I was on leave on the Chandelure, came back, and they had done we used to patrol the Bahamas 2 weeks every month. So go over for 14 days, back in port for 14 days. And I got lucky enough that we had enough qualified ODs that I could actually take one of those patrols off. And I so I got back from leave right after they pulled in, and they're like, "We're going to Baltimore." And no, we're not. They're like, "Yeah, we are." They ran over a charted coral head.
Oof.
Yeah. Both props, one shaft, one strut, one rudder. So it was the first strut replacement they ever did on a 110.
Is that the first one they extended to 23 to right after that happened?
No. Oh, I was at PCO PXO school when they said they were extending those to 123, and I'm like, so abandoned ship state. So in an emergency, everybody goes to the last 13 feet because that's the only good part of the boat at that point.
It's good.
I don't think anybody except the people who made that decision thought that was a good idea.
Oh, that was – Coast Guard is notorious for making horrible decisions with design. The 270s, they were supposed to be longer, but, you know, we needed to save money in order to have the same number of ships. So let's cut 50 feet out of the bow but not redesign any of the propulsion or anything so it rides bow down at full speed.
Which one is it? Is it Bear? Or what was the first
Bear.
One in that class?
Bear. Yeah, the Bear.
The door to nowhere.
You open a door, it goes nowhere.
The door to the pool.
Because it had already been constructed up to that point.
Yeah, like you, Phil, you open the door and there's just a bulkhead right behind it, but they never even took the door out.
Yeah.
Didn't even bother. Yeah. That's crazy. You know what's funny is that the Academy has like a naval engineering degree program. You would think like we have like a ton of naval engineers on staff, you know?
So in PCO PXO school, at least when I went through, you had to have one of the classes that we had was on stability, and it's taught by a naval engineer. And just to give you an idea about naval engineers, this guy was talking about stability like he was reading a Playboy. It's like, and you're sitting there going, it's really not that exciting, you know? Yes, it's important, but it's not that exciting.
When I got to the 210 and I was doing DCPQS, our DCA was that was his degree, was naval engineering, and he, same way. I'm like, keep the center of gravity over top of the center of buoyancy. It's all I need to know. Beyond that, like, I don't care.
It's pretty simple. Keep the bottom down and the top up.
Right. If you add weight, it might fall over.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to hop off screen for a second and go turn a better light on.
Okay. Well, Kurt, let's talk about Polar Star. What when you guys deployed, where'd you go? What was the cruise for?
So I only got to go to Antarctica on that one.
Okay.
Didn't get to go to the Arctic. So we did. I was on Deep Freeze 98. Ended up working out really. I had a great time. 5.5 month deployment. Left Seattle. Went down to Hawaii. My brother-in-law was stationed in Hawaii, so we tied up in Honolulu for about 30 days to go through CART, TISTA, go through training with the Navy, and we didn't get underway for any of it. It was all pier side. So every weekend while we were there, I got to go see my sister and her husband and kids, so I had a great time. Got underway.
You're the only person to ever say that about TISTA.
Yeah. Well, we had plenty of training on the way over because of the fires and major lube oil spill and everything else that we had on the way over. So our training.
That's why you didn't get underway. They were like,
oh, we'd have. So we'd have a general emergency, and I was part of the training team. So we'd have a general emergency, and I was part of DSAT. We'd have a general emergency, and then we'd sit down in the wardroom and write the drill for the next day based on the emergency we just had.
Right.
And the ref tray guys were like, this isn't how it's supposed to work. You're supposed to train before the emergency, not have the emergency and then run the drill to it. So
yeah, and you're like, hey, we're still floating and we got here, so I think we're good.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so we did okay with that. From Hawaii, we headed down to Sydney, Australia. Pulled into Sydney, had about 4 days. That's in Sydney. Great port, great time. From there, we went down to Hobart, Tasmania. Love that one. Not as metropolitan as Sydney. I like the more rural areas. And then from Hobart, we headed down to the ice. Enjoyed that one. It was really neat to go down there, see all of that. We broke about 13 miles of 13-foot thick ice into McMurdo. So I was able to qualify ice pilot and got my deck watch officer letter on the Polar Star for that.
What is an ice pilot, Kurt? What does an ice pilot do?
You're allowed to drive in the ice, navigate in the ice. So one of the things that, because you go in and out of McMurdo so often, and they don't have tugs down there, you're allowed to tie up without tug assist. Everywhere else, you got to use tugs on those boats. So I actually got the experience of tying up the Polar Star without tugs. And what fun that is. What a challenge. You're driving 18,000 displacement tons with 76,000 shaft horsepower, three controllable pitch propellers and one rudder. You can do anything you want with that boat. You just got to configure your props the right way.
That's crazy.
You can spin it in a circle. You know, you can walk it sideways. You can whatever. The only thing you got to be careful is when you put them to zero, they don't always go to zero. So, and it doesn't like to stop. So you got to plan way ahead.
Yeah, 18,000 tons probably takes a minute to slow down.
Yeah, the year before we went down there, the Polar Sea hit the ice pier, which was 40-foot thick, and cracked it.
Whew.
So we spent about 2 months down there, helped out some scientists. They're doing penguin research on one of the islands. So we dropped them off so they could count penguins. Marble Point has a helo refueling depot. That's part of the job, is you take on fuel and then you go up to Marble Point and you pump fuel to them, a couple hundred thousand gallons. You get in as close as you can, and then you pump the fuel to them, and then you got to recover all the fuel hose back to the ship. So it's quite a day. But once you get all the fuel hose recovered and on board, you can have beer. Or at least we could at the time. They put beer down on the ice. It's some good stuff. Stuff you pick up in Australia. So
it was good beer.
It was good beer. Oh, yeah. It was really
Foster's,
good beer.
Right? It was just Foster's. I mean, isn't that the only Australian beer?
Tui's and VB, Victoria Bitters, and DB. A bunch of good ones. So then we go So you break ice so you can get the oil tanker in, refuel McMurdo, and you get a container ship in to resupply it. Oil tanker came first for us, and then the freighter, the container ship. Container ship broke down on the way out of Antarctic, so we ended up having to tow it. One of the longest tows in Coast Guard history, from what I understood at the time.
Nice.
Hooked into it while it was still down inside the Antarctic, south of 60. It was right around 60 south. Towed it. So our captain had been fighting for a port called New Zealand since before we left Seattle. And New Zealand has a nuclear ban. And because U.S. military, you can either confirm or deny. Right. The Coast Guard hadn't been in there since the 80s. And they just kept saying, stop asking. They finally got to the point, they're like, stop asking. Well, out of the Antarctic, where we hooked up the tow, nearest safe port was Port Lyttelton, New Zealand, which is
that's
right
too
outside
bad.
So we towed them up to New Zealand, and then we ordered fuel and oil, and a verbal order of supplies is a contractual agreement. So we actually had to pick it up. The fuel tanks were down when we pulled in, so we had to wait 4 or 5 days.
Also, really too bad.
Yeah, darn.
They're like, it's going to be a working port. So it went from like the first day in port, we worked till 1600. The second day, we worked till 1300. And then we had liberty the rest of the time.
But, yeah, that's what the command always says. Oh, we're going to do a working. Yeah, no, you're not.
Yeah. But I was on watch up on the bridge when we were approaching Port Lyttelton. And I look out. We're still a ways off, a couple hours out. I look over to, off to the left, off to the west. And I see this line of clouds. And I had looked at the barometer, and the barometer climbed. It was a significant climb. So I'm got on the phone to the captain. I'm like, Captain, I've never seen this one. You need to come to the bridge. This is what the barometer did. And it looks like we're about to hit the squall. So we got hit by a squall. We got a 400-plus container ship in tow behind us. They got, I think they had 3 shots of anchor chain out. And we had 1,200 feet of 12-inch braided towing them.
That's a big line.
Yep, the winds hit them, and they hit us from the port side, and the container ship immediately went to port. And so I'm calling them to steer behind us, and they're like, we got the, they helms hard over, and it's not coming back. So Cap and I started talking. I'm like, and it finally dawned on me. I was like, this guy's got so much sail area. He's actually sailing. We're just kind of holding him at this point. So I bumped up, I increased the pitch on the props, picked up some speed. We'd been doing about 8 knots out of Antarctica the whole time, 8 to 10 knots. And I think I had it up to about 12 to 13 knots before he finally come in behind us. Okay. That was pretty neat. Yeah. And then, we dropped him at the anchorage, captain let me drive cause I'd had him, cause been on watch the whole time. He's, going into Port Lyttelton. And he's like, what do you want to do? I said, well, the easiest thing is just point into the wind, slow down until he's right over the anchorage spot, disconnect, let him drop anchor. And that's what we did. Just nice and easy. So, and he hooked up. But one tow with 12-inch braided, 1,200 feet, and we had to replace it.
Cut it loose at that point, just let it go.
No, they actually hauled up their anchor chain, disconnected. Yep. We hauled it back in, but it was completely smoked after a week towing them out of the Antarctic.
I just imagine hauling that line back in for the deckies, like
that's what I'm thinking. That's what I was saying. Like I just like it would definitely been in consideration. Let's just cut it.
Start chopping, boys.
Yeah.
I
mean, who's going to splice the new one? That's the other question.
Oh, you order those already spliced.
Good. Oh, there we go.
It's worth the extra cost.
Yeah.
But 12 inches was about, I think it, at that point, it was about $20,000 to replace it.
Man. Well, how often do you get the tow with the Polar Star? I mean, it's got to be like a... What, twice in a ship's lifetime, probably, that thing's towed?
It depends. So we ended up, so one of the things you would do is you'd tow the tanker away from the pier just because they don't have the, ability to maneuver very well. They can get in.
That doesn't count though. Cause that's not like, not the in extremis tow, right? Like if we don't get you out of here, you're going to be
extremis
forever.
Yeah, hardly ever. You'd be lucky if you did it in an entire tour on that ship.
That's very cool. That's a badge of honor right there. That's for sure. Yeah.
How many days was it roughly to get? Like, how many days were you towing them from Antarctica to New Zealand?
I think we were towing them a full week. I think it was 7 to 10 days. Yeah, it was a while.
That'll wear you out because that's a lot to keep track of.
It's the half hour tow line checks.
Right.
Bridge, stern. This is where it is. Okay, thanks.
It's the same place it was 30 minutes ago.
Understand. Yeah.
Let's talk about the elephant in the room, Kurt. Just real. What does an ATON officer do?
I wish nobody knows. You know, it's funny you ask. I wish I actually knew. 15 minutes after showing up at Southwest Harbor, they looked at me and said, "Oh, by the way, your job is going away, so you're going to need to find a new one."
There we go.
I did. So I wrote justification to suspend ice breaking on the Penobscot River because we didn't. And it's funny because at the same time, Chinbro up here in Maine was working on a contract to build modular refinery units, and they were shipped. The plan was they were going to ship them out of Bangor, Maine, on the Penobscot year round. So then you needed ice breaking. Well, that wasn't a guarantee at the time, and there was really no reason to do it. The other thing I did is I did AIDS navigation studies for the various areas, ports in the area to determine whether or not we needed all the aids that we had that were being used, or if we needed more, if we could do away with some. So that's what I did.
You know, if you told me you did absolutely nothing after that story about towing on the Polar Star, it would have been perfectly all right. I think people would have been like, all right, I get it. I get what, you know, we're just paying for what you know and what you've done versus what you're doing now.
Well, I had enough free time to go up and, pay visits to Loran Station up in Caribou.
Where's Caribou?
Maine.
Is it near Jonesport?
No, it's up up above Presque Isle. It's
in the what do they call it? The unsettled territory? Is that what it's called?
The county. We call it the county.
Washington County, right?
No, Aroostook County.
Okay.
Yeah, it's up further. It's
So you got to learn your AOR.
Dude, I feel bad for anybody.
In spring of 2008, we had floods up in Fort Kent. And so I got a call from Portland saying, how long would it take you to get to Fort Kent? And I was in the office down in Southwest Harbor. This is April. And I'm already short sleeve, my sleeves rolled up, no winter jacket with me or anything. And I'm like, that's about 6 hours, I believe. And they're like, okay, when can you be up there? I was like, well, I could be up there first thing in the morning. They're like, no. How soon from now can you be up there? I was like, I'm going to have to get home and pick up some supplies, but about 6 hours. And from Southwest Harbor, it's a 6-hour drive to Fort Kent. And when I got up to Fort Kent, it was snowing. And we had no snow in Southwest Harbor when I left.
Crazy.
Yeah. Maine is a much bigger state than most people realize.
Yeah, I think I don't think anything's within 30 minutes, like no matter where you live. It's just at least a 30 minute drive, at least.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 I go up to the county quite frequently, and it's I live down south of Augusta, and it's still a 3.5 hour drive for me.
Where do you live now? You're in Maine now?
Yeah, I'm in Maine now.
Okay. All right. Gotcha. But not born in or raised, or did you lived in Maine though, back with your family before you.
You marry those New England girls.
That's what'll do it. Yeah. All right.
My wife's family is from up in the county.
The county. I got you. Makes sense.
So, and the other thing is, if you take one of them to Guam, eventually you're going to have to pay back that trip.
Oh, she didn't like Guam, huh?
Ooh, no. They say there's two things that hit you when you get off the plane in Guam. The heat and your wife. I can vouch for both.
Which one hit harder?
Yeah, the second.
Yeah, right.
Well, talk to us about Guam. You were on buoy tenders out there, kind of two tours almost, right? Decommed one and then commissioned the next?
Yeah. So I was on the Polar Star and put in for it. It was that there was some discussions at the house, but I basically said, okay, we're going to Guam next. It wasn't a pleasant conversation for the next couple of weeks, but got to, we were in Hobart, Tasmania, and my wife called me up and said, you need to get your orders changed because they just had a super typhoon wipe out Guam. Well, the day before you leave for the ice is not the day to call the detailer. So I couldn't get my orders changed. Ended up in Guam on a buoy tender, and I put in for it because it was 180s. And at the time, the 180s weren't really doing well. They were older. They were seeing a lot more import days due to maintenance. And that was part of the reason I wanted to go. The other reason is you're coming back from the Antarctic, you got to thaw out somehow. And then the third reason is it's Guam. Why not? You know?
Right. It's Pacific Island, right?
It's Pacific Island. Hey, I've never been there. So let's go. So got on the island and wasn't on the island a week. The ship had just got, we were on the island about 2 or 3 days. The ship just came back from Kwajalein doing a buoy run out there, and they'd been gone for 5 weeks. Came back and we got underway for a week. I forget what it was for, but we got underway for a week, came back in for 2 weeks, left to Japan. We were gone 4 weeks. Now, you got to keep in mind, I got to the island. What I haven't said is we had an infant, a toddler, and a 9-year-old that
I'm
left.
Actually amazed you don't have to refer to this lady as your first wife.
I know, right? Yeah,
exactly.
She's a saint.
So I left her on the island with, yes. So went up to Japan. We were gone for 4 weeks, came back down, decommissioned the ship. And I flew to Hawaii to go through damage control school, which didn't have enough people for, and I ended up getting canceled. It's a 2-week steam from Guam to Hawaii. We were gone 2.5 months picking up the sassafras, 2 months, 2.5 months. So in the first 6 months, I was home 3 weeks. Ooh. And it was a 2-year assignment. We were doing Chinese migrant interdiction. So we pull in, we supposed to be in a maintenance status, Charlie status, and they get us underway on they'd pick up a Chinese boat via aircraft and spot it via aircraft, get us underway on a Monday, go intercept it, reroute it up to Tinian, drop them off. We get back to Guam on Thursday, turn around and do the same thing the following week. In 4 weeks, we intercepted 5 boats with over 600 migrants.
And wow. Where did you guys where'd you redirect them to?
Tinian.
Tinian. What is that?
It's part of the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas Islands. It's also a U.S. possession, U.S. territory. That's where they launched the Enola Gay and Boxcar from. They were doing the bomb strikes on Japan out of there. So they still got the runways. They still got the bomb pits where they loaded up the atomic bombs. It's still part of the U.S. It's not part of the U.S. for immigration purposes. So we were able to bring them up there, give them a different hearing. So it was a flip. You get if they made it to Guam, about 98% of them would stay in the U.S. If we were able to get them up to Tinian, about 98% would get shipped back to China. They didn't meet the requirements for immigration to the U.S. at that point. So anyway, did a lot of that, did a lot of fisheries. Went to Palau. That was a pretty good time. That was about a week down, 2 weeks there and a week back. So gone for 4 weeks again. My 180s don't get underway very much was not really an accurate statement for this assignment.
And the end of the story is now you live in Maine.
Yeah. Well, so out of 2 years on that assignment, I was home maybe, the last 6 months we were tied up, broken. Funny about that, how that happens on all the ships that I was on. But anyway, we were tied up, broken for the last 6 months. And with that 6 months in port for an entire 6 months, I was home half the time, underway half the time. So, yeah.
And she then from there, oh, from there you got the IMARV.
Yeah, then I got the IMARV. Yeah.
Where did you take the – you still had to take OIC boards.
I took it – Yeah, I went through the OIC board out of First District.
Oh, okay, all right.
When I was XPO at Provincetown.
Okay.
Yeah, and went up for the OIC boards up there.
Yeah, so you had to pass for a while before you came back to it, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah.
What do you think of that first command tour? I mean, I know the boat itself, but just being in command, what is, you know, what did command kind of mean to you as you went from there to the station, to the Beluga and beyond?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was a challenge. I think, you know, as far as the OIC tour, it was a challenge for a multitude of reasons. Wasn't as challenging as when I was XPO for a multitude of reasons there. OIC was a challenge. One, you know, at the IMARV, one due to the timing of it, you know, 9/11, the type of unit it was, a lot of stuff we were doing, transition on operating systems for computers and all of that. Because we were going through that, we didn't have connectivity, but we were still requiring to report all, you know, all your web-based programs were coming out. We just didn't have it, so you know,
we haven't solved that problem.
Yeah, nothing changed. Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to remember the admiral's name. He was commandant. He was Pap. Fifth district. No, he before him, before Pap, big guy.
Thad Allen.
Yes, Admiral Allen. He was 5th District Commander when I was at Taylor's Island. Had a discussion with him one day while I was up at Annapolis, and he asked me how it was working out. And I'm like, we haven't fired our underway logs for 6 months. Because we didn't have connectivity. In fact, I had a BM1 working on it while we were up at Annapolis. That's how we do it. We'd go up to Annapolis, tie up, get on a computer up there, and do all our reporting.
Yeah,
I actually CAS-rep the Coast Guard data network as a result of it.
So somebody needs to. I think more often, you know.
They weren't happy with me about that one. The XPO job was more challenging because we were having a run of maturity challenged individuals at the station. So
I like that.
I'm going to use that political way to put it.
I ended up standing as a BM1 at the small boat station, XPO. I stood an awful lot of duty.
Yeah.
You know,
that sucks.
But your wife was thrilled about that too.
No, I wasn't married at that time. So that was before I got married. Just to let you know how challenged they were maturity wise. I caught him mooning the OIC one day while he was talking to the group commander. We were in a meeting. I actually caught the guys too. He had a window up high in his office that there was a rec room up there, and they pulled the curtains back and backed up against the window. Yeah. One of the guys wasn't fast enough.
Yeah.
There was another day that they were watching the movie Seals. I think it was Seals. It's where the opening scene is they're riding in a Jeep and jump off the Jeep off the bridge. The Jeep's going across a bridge and they jump off it. Well, they were watching that and they're like, what a great idea. We had a quarter mile long pier and we had an S10 pickup as a pier vehicle. So a bunch of them piled into the back of the S10 pickup. And one of the guys drove down the pier. And when they got down towards the end, two guys went off one side, one guy went off the other side. It was at low tide.
Oh.
So they had to go quite a ways down the pier. Well, on one side, we had a floating dock and two boats. The other side, it was open water. I happened to be down at the end of the pier. It was night. They didn't know it. So by the time the one guy swam around from the other side of the pier, I had the other three guys standing at attention. He comes out of the water, gets onto the dock. He's like, "That was great. We got to do it again." Because he didn't notice me. Yeah. So
that's Claude Morrissey would put it, Bill, the real Coast Guard.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. A lot of great. A lot of mischievous going on. So, yeah.
Would you do it again?
Oh, yeah. In a heartbeat. Yeah. Yeah. No, I had a great time.
What do you think's the most, I don't know, give us a couple of most impactful life lessons, I guess, that you pulled out of the Coast Guard 25 years of service.
You got to work for everything that you get. You know, it's not going to come to you. You know, I think get everything you can out of the Coast Guard. But you got to work for it. And, you know, you make every effort you can to get yourself ahead. You know, learn your job, learn as much as you can while you can. You know, I think that's it. And do what you enjoy. To be honest, I, as a bosun's mate, I loved it. Driving boats, it came naturally to me. The leading and all of that, it took some effort and, you know, wasn't as natural. And, you know, so I had to learn it and I had to work at it, but, I enjoyed the job. I enjoyed the missions. In the long run, I enjoyed the people, even as frustrating as they were at times. one of the guys who jumped off the pier, and one of the same guys who mooned the senior chief, is now one of my best friends. You know,
it was kind of epic. That's kind of an epic move. Lacks all maturity, but it's pretty epic.
Oh yeah, I mean, we have a group inspection. The senior chief's sitting there talking to the group commander, and all of a sudden his head goes, he was an Irishman, his head just instantly red. And I look up and I said, "Excuse me, Captain, I need to go take care of something." And as soon as I got out of his office, I was on the run and I caught him. Oh yeah. Yeah.
That's cool though.
We had a third order Fresnel lens from a lighthouse as a display unit in the foyer to the station. And he's sitting there shining the brass. And as the senior chief and I walked into the foyer, one of the prisms just popped out. His hand wasn't even near that prism. It was a fluke. It just popped out and exploded on the ground. This is almost $1 million piece of
artifact. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. They're basically irreplaceable at this point.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And the look on his face, and he's like, "Oh, it wasn't me." I'm like, "Okay." Yeah. Sure.
Dude. We
busted him down at least once, I think. But he ended up retiring as a warrant, so he did good.
Yeah, he was all
right. Just needed to learn some maturity, right?
He did. That's exactly it.
When anybody says leadership's a challenge for him, that's what I always think. Is like, it's that moment you recognize that you have to be mature now. Everything you do, right?
Well, you don't. You don't have to. You just have to be the most mature in the group.
There you go. Fair enough.
Which is a low bar at times.
Yeah.
It can take a lot.
Yeah, when you realize that some of the things that you did as a E3, sometimes E4, probably weren't appropriate, and that although it was funny and although maybe the stuff that the guys just did was really funny, you can't show that it was really funny.
Not until you're out, and then you guys become best friends, and then you can go back to it.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I tried to get him to work for me later on, and his wife and my wife were like, "No, bad idea.
No.
Bad idea."
Well, Kurt, we really appreciate your time today. I know that we could talk for after 25 years as a BM and retiring as a bosun. There's no doubt that we'd go on forever. But
yeah, for sure.
And maybe we'll have you back on. But I'll give you any parting shots before we close it out.
No, it was really enjoyable talking with you guys, and good luck with your podcast and all.
Thanks for your time, Kurt.
My daughter turned me on to it, so thank you.
Awesome. No, we really appreciate her referring you to us, and we really appreciate your time and sharing your story and your support of the National Coast Guard Museum.
Oh, anytime. Thank you.
Well, stay safe with that high voltage up there, and stay warm this winter. I'll be there with you in Maine, so looking forward to it. All right.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Thanks again, Kurt.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform, and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.